lobster and a baked potato. I cut the potato open and I cover it with slices of butter and a spoonful of sour cream. I don't bother with the salad. At the end of the table, there is a cooler filled with soda, and I take a can of root beer. Root beer will be fine. I sit down next to Leonard and I start eating. As I do, I listen to him and Maddie and a pediatrician who is addicted to Xanax and a corporate lawyer who is a crackhead talk about the fight. Maddie is still rooting for the smaller of the men, Leonard for the bigger. The doctor talks about the blows to the head that both men have taken and the seriousness of the blows relative to their size. He predicts the larger man will win. The lawyer says the smaller. He feels it in his gut. I eat slowly. I start with the steak, cut it into pieces, cut those pieces into smaller pieces. I eat the pieces one at a time, occasionally putting some potato on top, occasionally dipping my fork into the butter and sour cream. I hold each bite, and I let it dissolve. I let the flavor of the rare red meat sink into my tongue. I let the juices fill my mouth. It is a fight not to eat more, to eat three or four pieces at a time, to eat five steaks, or maybe 10, or as many as I can get. But it is not a difficult fight. What I am eating is better than any meal I can remember having eaten at any point in the distant past. What I have is all I need. I am happy with it. I finish the steak, start breaking apart the lobster. I pull off its upper shell, pull the tail away from the torso. I cut open the soft underbelly of the tail and remove the meat in one thick piece. I hold it in my hand and I dip it into what remains of the butter. I take a bite. I hold the bite and I let it melt and I swallow it. I do it again and again. When I'm done with the tail, I break apart the claws. I pull out the meat and I eat it. The claws are as good as the tail. I finish and I am happy and I am full. I stand with my plate and I look at the banquet tables. There is more food on them. I don't take any. I will resist my urge to eat everything I see, to eat myself into a coma, to eat so that I no longer feel anything, to eat until I'm beyond feeling anything. I clear the scraps from my plate, put the plate in a bin with other plates. I get a new plate with a new steak and a new lobster and a new potato. I want it so bad. God damn, I want it. I walk to my room. I knock on the door. There's no answer. I open the door and I step inside. Miles is lying on his bed with his face in his pillow. I don't want to disturb him. I set the plate on his nightstand and I walk out. I close the door behind me and I go back to my seat. I look around me. I look at the other men, the bulk of whom are still eating. Most have food spread across their faces and down their shirts. Most have forgotten their forks and knives. Most are eating with their hands. They are tearing the steaks apart and stuffing them into their mouths, tearing the lobsters apart and stuffing them into their mouths, holding the potatoes in their fingers and eating them like apples. As they chew, they keep their mouths open, and they stuff more food in before they swallow what they are already chewing. In the brief moments between bites, they wipe away the mess with the sleeves of their shirts, with the backs of their hands, with paper napkins, so covered with stains that they are starting to disintegrate. They lick their fingers and their lips, lick the backs of their hands, lick the bones of the steaks, suck on the broken shells of the lobsters. I laugh at what I'm watching. It is like something from Rome, an orgy of food and an excess of need and desire. An orgy of gluttony and greed and hunger. No one cares what they look like or how they are acting. They just want more, more, more. No one cares about their addictions, the addictions they are here to deal with and learn to control. The addictions have been unleashed. The food is a drug, a drink, a chemical, a substance. No one cares that they are getting all they can handle, that they have more than they need. If they could, the men would eat the furniture, the bookshelves, the plates, the napkins, the banquet tables, the coffee machine. They would tear up the floor, eat the carpet, the glue, the nails, the floorboards. If it wasn't going to broadcast the fight, they would probably eat the television. No one cares what they are eating. They just want fucking more. Leonard checks his watch. He stands, his white suit covered with stains, and he announces that it is getting close to fight time. The men rush down to get whatever seats are still available near the television. They rush to the banquet tables for a final frenzy of food. Lincoln walks over and he tells Leonard that he has to go home. Leonard stands and thanks Lincoln for allowing this to happen, and then announces Lincoln's departure to the rest of the men. Lincoln walks out to a chorus of cheers. As soon as he is gone, Leonard pulls out a huge roll of cash and a notebook, and he announces that he is open for business. Men rush over and start placing bets. So many bets that Leonard can't keep track of them. $50, $10, a pair of shoes worth $15, a watch, a gold necklace, a bracelet. The orgy continues. One man wants to bet his wedding ring, but Leonard won't let him. I turn my attention to the television. Various experts are making predictions about the outcome of the fight. Maddie, who is sitting on the other side of Leonard, talks to the men on the television in his way of pseudo-cursing, calling them either smarty-pants mofos or panty-waist fruckers. Someone tells him he should give it up and just start swearing again, and he tells them, "No way, no way, I ain't ever gonna freaking swear again." The commentators announce that it is time for the fight, and the room becomes quiet, and all the men focus on the television. The fighters make their way to the ring. The larger man, who is the challenger, enters first. He is about 6'5", weighs around 240 pounds, and has a body like a bear, which has thick layers of muscle and a thin layer of fat. The smaller man, who is the current champion, is 6'3", and 225 pounds. Unlike his opponent, there is not an ounce of fat on his body, and his dark skin glistens as if he's been carved out of polished steel. Both of them are covered with beads of sweat, which indicates that they are warmed up and ready to fight. It is going to be a fun night. After the national anthem and the introductions, the bell rings, starting the first round. Rounds in boxing are 3 minutes long, with 1 minute breaks in between each of the 12 rounds. In most fights, the fighters spend the first two rounds feeling each other out for their respective strengths and weaknesses. They then spend the rest of the fight avoiding the other's strengths and exploiting his weaknesses. There is none of that bullshit in this fight. The fighters rush toward each other and immediately start throwing huge, dangerous punches. The only apparent strategy is to try and destroy the other fighter as soon as possible. About 30 seconds into the fight, the smaller man lands a right hand directly on the larger man's jaw. The larger man's legs shake, and he stumbles backward. The smaller man pursues him, traps him against the ring ropes, and spends the next minute mercilessly pounding the larger man's ribs, stomach, shoulders, and jaw. When the smaller man's arms tire, and he can no longer throw punches, the larger man starts his counterattack. He pushes the smaller man back and starts beating him in the same way that he was just being beaten. At the end of the round, both men stumble back to their corners. I am on my feet cheering and yelling the entire time, as are most of the men on the unit. The next four rounds follow the same pattern as the first. The bell rings, the fighters meet. They try to knock each other out. There is no defense and no strategy. Both of their faces start to swell. Both start bleeding from their mouths, from their noses, and from cuts above their eyes. Both start to accumulate welts from the ropes and leather burns from the gloves on their chests, backs, and shoulders. Nobody in the unit sits down the entire time. Whether they will admit it or not, all men love fighting. Watching it or engaging in it ignites in us our true selves, the selves that have been diluted by thousands of years of culture and refinement, the selves that we are constantly told to deny for the greater good. To stand alone in front of another man, and to either hurt him or be hurt, is what men were built to do. Boxing allows us to live with the most base of those instincts, and to still feel a sense of what it is like to fight. The sixth round starts. Both men look exhausted, as if their bodies don't want to fight anymore, but their minds and their hearts won't let them stop. They walk methodically to the center of the ring and start slowly circling each other. They each throw a couple of harmless jabs, straight punches with their weaker arm, designed more to keep an opponent away than to hurt him. And then the smaller man strikes. He throws a wide, winging left hook that lands directly on the larger man's jaw. The larger man goes down, as if his legs have been swept from beneath him, and he lands on his back, his eyes straight toward the ceiling. The unit goes crazy. Men are screaming and shaking their fists, some yelling, "Stay down!" Some yelling, "Get up!" And above all of them I hear Maddie hollering, "He's gonna do it! My man is gonna do it!" The larger man sits up, shakes his head, and at the count of nine he stands. The referee asks him if he's okay, and he says yes, though it is clear he is not, clear that he is barely conscious. The referee motions for the men to start fighting again, and they both warily step forward. Maddie is screaming for the smaller man to hit him, to knock him out. "One shot will do it. Just knock him out." But the smaller man can't do it. It is as if his last punch, that last beautiful hook, took as much out of him as it took from his opponent. For the rest of the round, they paw each other, both too exhausted to throw real punches. In between the rounds, Maddie stands and he starts pacing. Leonard tells him to sit down, but Maddie can't do it. He is shaking his head and kicking the floor, imploring the smaller fighter to come out and ruin the larger fighter. When the bell rings, he's screaming, "Come on, you bastard, come on!" The round starts slowly, but about 30 seconds into it, as the fighters stand in the middle of the ring, the larger man throws a straight right hand that connects on the smaller man's nose. There is an explosion of blood as the nose breaks, and the smaller man falls to his knees. From there, he falls face down on the canvas. The room erupts. Most of the men are yelling, "Get up! Get up!" A few are high-fiving each other and saying, "It's over." At the count of eight, the smaller fighter struggles to his feet, and the referee asks him if he's all right. And through the blood in his face and the blood in his mouth, he says, "Yes." The referee steps aside, and the larger man steps forward and drills another perfect right hand into the smaller man's nose. The smaller man falls backward, through the ropes, and onto the ring apron. His eyes are closed, and he is not moving. The fight is over. Men cheer, yell, swear, throw empty soda cans at the television, get up and walk away. Amid all of the noise, I hear one thing above everything else. It is Maddie screaming, "Fuck, fuck, fuck, fuck!" He is staring at the television in utter disbelief, just staring and screaming, "Fuck, fuck, 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 fuck!" Leonard stands and he puts his arm around him and he says, "It's just a fight, it's not a big deal." And Maddie stops screaming and he says, "I know, but when the guy I want to win doesn't fucking win, it breaks my fucking heart." Leonard says he knows the feeling, and he gives Maddie a hug. They separate, and Maddie says, "Fuck!" at the television one more time, and Leonard starts walking around the room settling his various bets. He had most of his money on the larger man, but, in a gesture of goodwill, he waives all the bets that he has won, and he pays on all of the bets that he has lost. I stay up late talking with Maddie and Ted and Leonard and other men who come and go. We talk about the fight, and we let Maddie do most of the talking. Any pretense of him not swearing is gone, gone, gone. We eat apple pie and ice cream. We smoke cigarettes and drink coffee. We watch the highlights of the fight on the news, and we relive the experience of watching it again and again. No one goes to sleep. The unit is crowded at 2 o'clock in the morning. Tomorrow we go back to reality. Everyone stays awake because no one wants the night to end. At about 4 in the morning, I get off the couch and I walk to my room. I open the door. It is dark and quiet. Miles is asleep. I climb into my bed and I put my head down, and I think of Lily. I think of her sleeping in the medical unit, and I think about how close she is to me, and I think about how far away she is from me. How far away. She is in the medical unit, and it is close, but a world away. I miss her. I miss her. Tonight was one of the best nights of my life. Food and friends and a fight. Things I love with people I love. It was almost perfect. Almost. I miss Lily. I miss Lily. I miss Lily. I wake. I don't remember falling asleep, and I don't remember sleeping. There were no dreams. No dreams. I get out of bed. There is sun coming through the window. Bright sun. I don't remember the last time I saw the sun. I go to the bathroom and I shower and I brush my teeth and I shave. I avoid the mirror. I don't look at my eyes and I don't look at myself. I shower, brush my teeth, shave. I get dressed and I leave my room. I walk into the unit. Men are doing their jobs. I look at the job board to see if I have one, and my name is listed beneath the word greeter. I laugh. I am the greeter. It is my job to greet. It makes me laugh. I walk to breakfast. The halls are bright. I don't care about the halls anymore. They are what they are. I can't change them. I get a tray and a plate of waffles and a cup of coffee and a jelly donut. I walk into the dining room. I see my friends sitting at a table in the corner. They are always in the corner. I sit down. Miles, Leonard, Maddie, and Ted. There is a new man sitting at the end of the table away from us. I look at Leonard, motion toward the man, and Leonard shrugs. I am now the greeter. I decide to greet the man. I move to the end of the table. I sit across from the man. He is old, probably in his late 60s. He has short gray hair that is thick for his age, and though it is messy and spiked, it could be easily straightened with a comb. He is very thin and gaunt. His skin is covered with liver spots. His veins bulge beneath the skin of his hands. He is staring at his plate. He is slowly eating a wet pile of scrambled eggs and cheese. I speak. Hi. He looks up. He has sharp blue eyes. One of them is bruised and black. He has a long, thin nose and thin lips. The area above his upper lip and beneath his nose is covered with bleeding blisters. What do you want? His voice is lean and stiff, like the snap of a ruler on a desk. I'm the greeter. I came to greet you. Go greet someone else. I laugh. Go away. I laugh again. Go away, you little fucker. I reach across the table, offer my hand. I'm James. He doesn't take it. Go away, James, you fucker. Why don't you come sit with me and my friends? I motion toward the other end of the table. My friends are watching me. The man looks at them, looks back at me. I'd rather be alone. No, you wouldn't. Yes, I would. If you really wanted to be alone, you'd be sitting at an empty table. The man stares at me, and I stare back. He's tense. I'm not. You're a little fucker. I smile. I know. My name is Michael. Nice to meet you, Michael. He stands, and he moves toward the other end of the table, and I follow him. We sit, and I introduce him to everyone. At first he is quiet. He sits and he listens to us talk. We are talking about the man with no arms who left this morning and said he was going to find some smack. He didn't care that he didn't have arms. He just wanted some fucking smack. He starts asking questions about the man, about us, about what we do and why we are here. We answer his questions and we start asking him questions. At first he doesn't reply, but after a few minutes he says, "What the fuck? You're going to find out anyway." He tells us that he is a high-level administrator at a large Catholic university in the Midwest. He tells us that he has been married for 51 years and that he has 7 children. He tells us that after the last of them was born, his wife stopped having sex with him because she didn't want any more children and because she believed that sex was intended for procreation and procreation alone. He tells us he started seeing hookers, not expensive ones, but girls off the street. He tells us that he became addicted to them, and to the danger of being with them, and to the danger of getting a disease from them. He tells us that one of the hookers gave him some crack, and he started smoking it, and he became addicted to it. His addictions became part of each other. He needed hookers, and he needed crack. He couldn't have one without having the other, and he needed them both all the time. He needed hookers and crack every single day. He got caught when a student at the university, who was also a hooker, recognized him and tried to blackmail him. He decided it was time to stop, so he went to a priest and he confessed. The priest told him to tell his wife, and his wife forgave him on the condition that he stopped doing it. He couldn't stop. He did it that day, and again the next day. He left his wife, and he spent 8 days in a cheap motel with all of the hookers and crack that he could afford to buy. He smoked so much that he burned his mouth with his pipe. When he ran out of money, he went home, and his wife was waiting for him. She called the priest, the same priest. The priest drove him here. He arrived 4 days ago, and he has been at the medical unit being detoxified. We laugh at him, and we laugh at his story. At first he is angry and confused by us and our laughing. He doesn't understand it. We continue to laugh. We start telling stories of our own. Maddie talks about smoking with a hooker who burned his testicles with a butane torch. Ted talks about smoking with his mama and going line dancing with her while they were high. I talk about getting drunk with a hooker and passing out and waking up in an alley without my pants and without my shoes and finding my empty wallet jammed between my ass cheeks. We tell stories and we laugh at each other, and Michael the Catholic comes to understand that we are not laughing at him but with him, that we are the same as him, and that we are as awful as he is, and that we are not judging him. He starts laughing. We are all awful. It is easier to laugh at ourselves than cry at ourselves. We are all awful. We finish eating and we put away our trays and we go to the lecture. It is about drugs and alcohol in the workplace. Michael is the only one of us who pays attention. The rest of us play cards. When the lecture ends, Leonard gives envelopes to Maddie and Ted and Miles. He tells them to open them after he's gone. He tells me to meet him at his room at 11 o'clock. We walk out of the lecture hall and Joanne is waiting for me near the door. She asks me to come to her office. We walk through the halls, and when we get there, she sits on the couch, and I sit on the chair. We both light cigarettes. She speaks.
Heard you were in a crack house the other night.
I was in a place where a bunch of people smoke crack, but it wasn't a crack house.
What's the difference?
Crack houses usually have a supply on hand, and they're usually run by someone and kept secure by them. This was just a deserted old building where people go smoke.
What was it like?
Smelled bad.
That's what you remember?
No. She nods and she waits for me to offer more. When I don't, she speaks.
Were you near it?
Yeah.
How close?
Touched it and could have done it.
Did you want to?
Very badly.
Why didn't you?
I made a decision not to.
Simple as that?
Simple as that.
You make it sound easy.
It wasn't.
You think you'll be able to do it in the long term?
It'll be harder than it was the other night, but I do.
Why will it be harder?
I love Lily more than I love getting fucked up. That made the decision whether to help her or take care of myself an easy decision to make. When I'm alone with it, be it the rock or the bottle, it will be more about me and whether I want to take care of myself or not.
Which do you think it will be?
You know what I think. She smiles.
I saw Lily this morning.
Where?
I went down to the medical unit to check on her.
How is she?
All things considered, she's good. I think she's more worried and embarrassed than anything else.
What's she worried about?
Her grandmother, and finding the money to stay here.
Is there any kind of aid she can get?
There is, though it usually takes a while to work it out. We're trying to rush it through.
Will she get to stay?
I hope so.
What if she doesn't?
I don't know.
I look away. I stare out the window behind Joanne's desk. It is bright and sunny outside, like a morning in spring. A morning full of life. A morning full of new beginnings. I could still run. Run from jail and run from my past. Run with Lily. Run until we're safe and run until we find ourselves a life. Running is still an option, but I don't want to run. I have run my entire life. I am tired of running. I stare out the window, but the window is without answers. They will come in time. It is a morning full of new beginnings.
What are you thinking about?
Answers.
You have any?
No.
You will. Answers always come.
I'm starting to learn that.
She lights another cigarette. I light another cigarette. I want to talk to you about your inventory and the rest of your time here.
Okay.
Ken told me you think you'll be finished with the inventory by the end of the day.
Yeah.
That's pretty quick.
I know what I need to say.
The idea of this is to clear your conscience so that you can start your life over without guilt, regret, and shame. You think you'll be able to achieve that with what you want to talk about?
I do.
Ken said you might have issues doing this with a priest. It might be uncomfortable for him. The priests who do this hear some pretty awful things. Whoever you have, I'm sure he'll be able to handle it.
If you say so.
Is it something you want to talk about with me?
No.
Does this have anything to do with the way you feel about God?
Whatever's happened between me and any priest has nothing to do with my feelings about God.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Fair enough. When do you want to do it?
As soon as possible.
First thing in the morning?
Yeah.
I'll schedule a room and a priest. I'll make sure the priest will be able to deal with whatever you have to say. Come by my office after breakfast, and I'll walk you over.
Thank you.
After you're through, your program is basically finished.
What's that mean?
It means it will be time for you to leave.
When?
The day after tomorrow.
I smile.
Excellent. Do you have any plans?
Maybe see my brother for a couple of days, then I'll go down to Ohio and do my time.
I hear you're happy with the outcome of that situation.
Yeah, I am. Very happy.
Any worries?
No, I just want to be done with it.
What are you going to do about Lily?
Hopefully she'll be here. Since I won't, I'm assuming I'll be able to speak with her and we'll figure something out. If she doesn't stay here, we'll figure something else out.
Like what?
I don't know. I'm hoping she stays here.
She nods, waits for more. When I don't give more, she speaks. Come find me if you have any questions while you're doing your inventory.
I will.
I stand and I leave. On my way out, I look at her clock. It's almost 11. I make my way back to the unit and I knock on Leonard's door. He says, "Who is it?" And I say, "James." He says, "Come in." And I open the door and I step inside. There is a small black leather suitcase sitting on the floor next to the door. An open garment bag is spread across his bed. He is carefully filling the garment bag with precisely folded shirts. He speaks.
"How you doing, kid?"
I sit on the edge of the bed.
"Good. How are you?"
"I'm happy to be leaving."
"What are you going to do with yourself?"
"Got one of my boys picking me up, and we're going to drive back to Vegas. Probably stop and see Mount Rushmore and Old Faithful, and a few of the sights along the way."
I chuckle.
"Sounds cool. You got any plans yet?"
"Looks like I'm getting out day after tomorrow. I'm going to try to get hold of my brother and spend a few days with him. After that, I go down to Ohio."
"You worried about Ohio?"
"No."
"I probably don't need to tell you this, but if anybody fucks with you, go after them. Just showing them you're willing to fight will keep them away."
"I'm hoping to avoid that shit, but I'll do whatever I have to do."
He smiles.
"You're a good kid."
I laugh.
"Thanks, Leonard."
He finishes packing the garment bag and he closes it. He reaches into his back pocket and he pulls out his wallet and he removes a small card, like a business card. He sits on the bed across from me, and he hands me the card.
"Those are all my numbers and the places where you can get hold of me."
I take it.
"If you ever need anything, doesn't matter where you are or what you need, you find me, and I'll take care of you."
I look at the card, look up at Leonard.
"There are 5 different last names on here, Leonard."
He smiles. "I use different names in different places. The numbers correspond to the names. The Vegas number is the best, but they can find me at any of them." I put the card in my pocket.
"Thank you, Leonard."
He nods.
I also heard Lily was having some financial issues. I don't want you to worry about them anymore. She is going to stay here, and she is going to be fine. I smile.
What?
He smiles. Love is a beautiful thing, kid. You shouldn't have done that, Leonard. You say thank you, kid. I smile. Thank you, Leonard. Thank you so much. He nods again.
One last thing.
What? Before I say this, I want to say that I mean no disrespect to you or your family or your father. So if you feel or you think he'll be uncomfortable with what I'm going to tell you, let me know.
Okay.
He takes a deep breath, holds it for a moment, exhales. He looks as nervous as I've ever seen him.
I have always wanted to be married. I have always wanted to have children. More specifically, I have always wanted to have a son. I have been thinking about this for a while now, basically since the first day I met you, and I have decided that from now on, I would like you to be my son. I will watch out for you as I would if you were my real son, and I will offer you advice and help guide you through your life. When you are with me, and I plan on seeing you after we both leave here, you will be introduced as my son, and you will be treated as such. In return, I ask that you keep me involved in what you are doing and allow me to take part in it. Outside of here, I see our relationship functioning to a certain extent, just like it did in here. We are friends. We trust each other. We help each other make it through shitty times. We enjoy the good times together. If there are ever issues with your real father, I will insist you defer to and respect him before me and over me.
Is this a joke, Leonard?
He shakes his head.
No, not even close.
You want me to be your son?
He nods.
Yes.
You sure about that, Leonard?
I'm kind of fucked up.
I know what your problems are, kid, believe me. But if I had a son, I would want him to be like you.
I smile.
Sounds cool to me.
You sure about that, kid?
Yeah.
I'm kind of fucked up.
I laugh.
Doesn't bother me.
He laughs.
Good.
He stands.
Now pick up one of these goddamn bags and walk me out of here. This isn't going to be all fun and fucking games.
I laugh and I stand and I pick up the suitcase. Leonard grabs his garment bag and he puts it over his shoulder and we walk out of the room. We walk through the halls. He asks me to say goodbye to everyone for him, tells me he didn't want to do it himself. He doesn't like goodbyes, and he has said too many of them in his life. He asks me to give Miles and Maddie and Ted the number on the card that corresponds to his real name, and I tell him I will, and he asks me not to show the card to anyone else. I tell him I will keep it safe, and I will keep it private. We walk through the lobby of the clinic, and past the receptionist, and through the front door. There was a large, white, brand-new Mercedes-Benz sitting at the curb. The driver's door opens, and a tall, thick man in a black silk suit steps out. The man has a long, deep scar along one of his cheeks, and he looks like a bear. A mean bear. A bear who would eat a person alive if given the chance. Leonard smiles.
"Snapper!"
The man speaks.
"Hey, boss."
They hug and they separate. Leonard speaks.
"Thanks for coming."
"Of course."
"This the new car?"
"Yeah, you like it?"
"I do. It's white and it's new. Just what I wanted."
"Good."
Leonard turns to me, motions me forward.
"James?"
I step toward him.
"This is the Snapper. He's one of my closest friends and an associate of mine. They don't call him the Snapper because he likes fish, so be careful. Snapper, this is my son, James."
We shake hands. The Snapper looks at Leonard.
"This the one you told me about?"
Leonard nods.
"Yeah, and he's a whole lot meaner than he looks, so you be careful, too."
The Snapper laughs, looks back at me.
"Nice to meet you, kid."
"Yeah, you too."
Leonard opens the back door of the car and throws his garment bag onto the back seat. He motions for me to bring the suitcase, and I step forward and toss it onto the back seat. Leonard shuts the door, and he turns to the snapper.
Let's get this show on the fucking road, Snap.
You got it, boss.
The snapper walks around the car and sits down behind the wheel. Leonard turns back to me.
You need anything, you call me. Don't forget that.
I won't.
It's been great getting better with you. I'll be in touch soon.
Thanks for everything, Leonard. In a lot of ways, you saved my life.
Thank you.
He smiles. You saved your own life. I smile. Leonard steps forward. He puts his arms around me and he hugs me. I put my arms around him and I hug him. He lets go and he steps away and he looks in my eyes and he speaks.
Be strong. Live honorably and with dignity. When you don't think you can, hold on. I'm proud of you, and you should be proud of yourself.
I look back in his eyes.
I'll miss you, Leonard. We'll see each other soon, my son.
I nod. I force myself not to cry. Leonard turns and he opens the passenger door of the car, and he sits down and he shuts the door, and the car pulls away. I stand and I watch it. As it drives down the road leading in and out of the clinic, the passenger's window goes down, and a fist, a tight, closed fist, emerges from it. The fist is held high in the air. As I watch the fist and Leonard and all that they represent to me drive away, I almost start to cry. Leonard and his fist. I almost start to cry. I stand there looking down the road after the car is gone. I stand there for 5 minutes looking down the road. It is hard to imagine that Leonard is gone. Strange and kind and vicious and magnificent Leonard. Satan and saint. I am going to miss him. I am going to miss him. I turn and I walk back into the clinic. I make my way to the dining hall. I get in line and I get a tray and a plate of tuna noodle casserole. The meals are starting to repeat themselves. I have had tuna noodle casserole before. I hope I don't ever have it again. I sit down alone at an empty table. I start eating. I can't tell which part is tuna and which part is noodle and which part is casserole. I eat anyway. One bite after another, I fill my stomach. I miss Lily and I miss Leonard. I am alone at an empty table. I fill my stomach. One bite after another. I finish my plate. I start to stand. I want another plate. I want 40 or 50 plates. I want a fucking vat of this tuna noodle bullshit. I see Miles walking toward me. He is smiling. I sit back down. I still want more. More, more, more.
Hello, James.
Miles sits down across from me.
Hi.
He puts a napkin on his lap, picks up a fork.
How are you today?
I'm okay. You?
I have some good news.
What?
My wife called me this morning.
What did she say?
She said she stayed up all night thinking about us, and she spent a long time sitting and staring at our baby, and she decided to give me a second chance. She is going to come here and enroll in the family program, and we are going to try and work things out between us. There are no guarantees, but we're going to try.
I smile.
That's great. Quite an improvement over yesterday.
To say the least.
I don't know if congratulations is the right word, but congratulations.
He smiles.
Thank you, James. Thank you.
We don't speak anymore. We just sit. He eats, and I stare across the dining hall. It's comfortable, relaxing, pleasant, to sit and not talk, to sit and stare at nothing, to sit and let the mind shut down, to just sit. There is no awkwardness and no anxiety. Miles is in his world, and I am in mine. We just sit. Miles finishes eating, and he stands, and he waits for me to notice him standing. When I do, I stand, and we put our trays away.
We walk through the halls, and Miles goes to the lecture, and I don't. He asks why I'm not going, and I tell him, if I am leaving in 2 days, I don't want or need to sit through any more lectures, that I have been lectured enough. He laughs, and I walk back to the unit, and I go to the telephone booth. I call my mother and father. They are on the other side of the world, and it is the early morning there. My father answers the phone. He sounds as if he's asleep. I ask him if I should call him back, and he says, no, hold on for a second. I wait. My mother picks up the phone and says hello, and she also sounds as if she's asleep. My father picks up another phone. There is an echo and a delay. I tell them I am leaving in 2 days. They are both surprised. My father asks me if I am ready to leave, and I tell him I feel ready, but that I won't know how ready until after I'm gone. My mother asks what that means, and I tell her I won't know how much better I am, if I am better at all, until I am in the outside world. My dad asks what that means, and I tell him that it's easy to stay sober in here because there is nothing to tempt me. He asks me if I am ready to deal with temptation, and I tell him I believe that I am, but that I won't know until I leave. He sighs as if he is frustrated. My mother sighs as if she is frustrated. I ask them how they are, and they say they are fine. I ask them how Tokyo is, and my mother says they wish they were closer to me so that they could offer me more support. I tell her that they have done more than enough. My father tells me he's worried about me, and I tell him he shouldn't be, that I have never felt better or stronger in my life. He says that is reassuring. He doesn't sound as if he thinks it's reassuring. They ask me what my plans are, and I tell them I'm going to call Bob and try to spend a couple of days with him, and then I am going to go to Ohio and start serving my time. They ask me how I'm going to get there, and I tell them I'm probably going to take a bus. They offer to get me a plane ticket, and I say thank you, but no. My mother asks me if I need anything, and I tell her no. My father asks me to call them when I am with Bob, and I tell them I will. He tells me to be careful. I tell him I will. My mother tells me to be careful. I tell her I will. They tell me they love me, and I tell them I love them, and we hang up. I call my brother. He is not home, so I speak into his answering machine. I tell him that I'm being released the day after tomorrow and that I would like it if he could come pick me up. I tell him that if he can't, not to worry about it, that I'll find my way. I ask him whether he picks me up or not, if I can stay with him for a couple of days, if I can sleep on his couch or on his floor or wherever there is space. I ask him to call me back. I leave him the number. I hang up. I step out of the phone booth, and I walk to the shelves where I found the crayons for my coloring book. Next to the crayons, there is a small stack of yellow legal pads. Next to the pads is a coffee mug full of pens. I take a pad and a pen, and I walk to the upper level, and I get a tall cup of coffee, steaming hot and black. I put the pen in my pocket, and I carry the pad in one hand and the coffee in the other, and I walk back down the stairs. I open the sliding glass door with my foot, and I step outside. The sun is shining, bright and high, though not warm. A slow breeze moves the air like a whisper. I walk across stiff grass, frozen now, and for the term of winter. I walk toward the lake. It is hard and still, and it is covered in a shell of ice. I sit down on one of the benches, the middle bench, and I take a sip of the coffee and I light a cigarette. I look at the pad. And the pad is yellow and empty. I start thinking back across the length of my life. I start thinking about all that I have done, and all that I have done that was wrong. I start young, or as young as I can remember. I was bad even then, as young as I can remember. I start writing. Ran over a nursery school teacher with a big wheel. I did it on purpose. I was 4. Hit a boy with a book bag full of books and broke his nose. His name was Fred. I was 6. Dug a hole and tricked a boy named Michael into climbing into the hole. I put a board over the hole and I sat on it for 3 hours. He cried and cried and cried. I laughed. I was 7. put a boy named David in a coat box at my parents' church, put a padlock on the box, and flushed the key down the toilet. Got permanently banned from Sunday school. I was 7. Stole a pack of menthol cigarettes from my friend Clay's mother, smoked them and threw up, stole another pack, threw up, stole another pack. I was 8. As I write the wrongs of my early childhood, most of them make me laugh. They were stupid, the actions of a kid who didn't know any better, or who didn't give a fuck if he did know better. I write 4 pages of them, things I did. They make me laugh. I start writing again from the age of 10, the age when I started to lose control. Thinking back, it seems like maybe I didn't do the things I did, that someone else did them, and I just watched. I wish it were so. I started to lose control at 10. Snuck out of the house and got drunk. Stole liquor from my parents more times than I can count or remember. Stole a stack of porn magazines from my neighbor's garage. Caused a traffic accident by egging a random car. I watched the aftermath from the top of a tree. No one was hurt, though there was bent steel. Got caught mooning the principal of my school on a Friday night while I was supposed to be in my bed. Was dragged home by the principal while my parents were having a dinner party. I ruined the party and humiliated my parents. I stole a bag of pot from my friend Sean's father. I stole a pipe from Sean's father. I stole a bottle of pills from Sean's father. I smoked the pot in the pipe and took all of the pills. They made me vomit. I did it again the next time I was at Sean's house. 3 more pages, filled with stolen chemicals and stupid pranks. Sometimes I got caught, most of the time I didn't. At 12, the memories start to lose themselves in the haze of liquor and drugs. At 12, my life was blurred. Attacked a kid in a hockey game. He wasn't looking, and I blindsided him. I knocked him out, and I stood over him, and I laughed. I filled a teacher's mailbox with bags of dog shit every night for 3 weeks. I lit a Boy Scout leader's tent on fire while on a camping trip. I got thrown out of the troop. I filled the gas tank of a neighbor's car with sugar and wrecked his engine. I stole liquor and drugs from wherever I could find them, whenever I was near them. 5 pages covering 3 years. Hurt people who didn't deserve to be hurt. Hurt people who did deserve it. Started to contemplate death. Started to realize I was fucked. Started to hate myself. I did what I did because I hated myself. At 14, I stole a moped and pushed it off a cliff. I took a sledgehammer to a sculpture in a neighbor's lawn. I blew up a mailbox, 2 mailboxes, 4 mailboxes, 10. I learned the strength of words, and I used them. I called a girl a fat wench. I told a pregnant teacher I hoped her child was born dead. I asked a doctor's wife if she knew her husband was having an affair. She had been mean to my mother, and I didn't want to let this woman get away with that. Her husband was having an affair. The marriage fell apart. At 15, I sold drugs to kids. I sold them alcohol. They were my age, but they were still kids. Most of the time I ripped them off, took too much of their money, or sold them oregano. Sometimes I pissed in the bottles before I gave them the bottles. I destroyed a drive-in sign at a local fast food restaurant. I took a hammer to it in the middle of the night because the manager had kicked me out of the place while I was drunk. I snuck out of my house. I snuck out the car. I got drunk and I did drugs. All the time. 16 and 17 and 18 take up 5 pages. More of the same, drinking and drugs, sneaking out and vandalizing, saying things to hurt people if they hurt me or hurt someone around me. I trashed the yard of a local Christian youth group leader when he tried to recruit me. I trashed it every Friday night for 8 straight weeks. I stole the mail of a neighbor who had bad-mouthed me. I stole it to get all of his personal information, and I signed him up for 12 credit cards and wrecked his credit rating. The level of my addictions grew. The level of my self-hatred grew. The level of my destruction grew. 19 and 20, 6 pages. My first years at college, I cheated on a girlfriend once, twice, 3 times, got caught every time. Told her I would change. It wouldn't happen again. I knew it would. I did it to another girl. To another. Lying became part of my life. I lied if I needed to lie to get something or get out of something. I cheated at school. I took money from my parents and I spent it on drugs. I took more money and I bought more drugs. I terrorized a kid named Rob because I heard him say something about her with the Arctic eyes. I vandalized his car and his room. I taunted him and threatened him and intimidated him. I made his life miserable. I never told him why I was doing it. I just did. 21, 3 pages. Drank, smoked, got arrested, doled out a beating or two, took a beating or two, cheated, lied, deceived, used women, slept with prostitutes, took more money, wasted more money. My best friends were drugs and alcohol. Those who tried to stop me were told to fuck off and leave me alone. I made a girl snort lines off my dick. She was a cocaine addict, and I traded drugs for her body. She let me do whatever I wanted, and I did too much too often. Drugs and her body. I held a gun to a man's head. It was an unloaded gun, but he didn't know it was unloaded. He was on his knees begging for his life. I did it for a drug dealer who wanted to test me, and I needed his trust because I needed his drugs. The man had stolen from the dealer. I pulled the trigger of the unloaded gun. The man pissed in his pants and pissed on the floor. The dealer rubbed his face in it, and I watched. 22. 2 pages. My arrest, the arrest in Ohio, the arrest I will pay for with time in a cell. A girl in Paris claimed I was the father of her child. I wasn't. I hadn't been able to stay erect with her. I had never been hard inside of her. She was begging and crying for me to take responsibility for the child, but I wasn't the father. So I threw her out of my apartment. In a bar 2 days later, one of her girlfriends came after me with a bottle, and I floored her. When she got up, I kicked her in the ass and told her if she came near me again, I'd beat her silly. Another girl I knew carried me back to her apartment one night after she found me passed out in the street. I vomited and pissed on her couch and on her floor. When I woke up, I took a bottle of vodka and I walked out. I never saw her or heard from her again. I hit a man with a chair at a bar in London. He had spilled a drink on my table, and I hit him when his back was turned. I didn't bother waiting around to survey the damage. I never bothered waiting around to survey the damage. I finish writing. The coffee is gone, and I have smoked a pack of cigarettes. I look at the stack of paper, count the pages. There are 22 of them. 22 pages filled with my wrongs, my mistakes, my lapses in judgment, and my bad decisions. 22 pages filled with my anger, rage, addiction, self-hatred, and fury. 22 pages documenting my disgraceful, embarrassing, and pathetic life. 22 pages. I read the pages, slowly and carefully. I read them. As I do, I think about whether I am leaving anything out. Is there anything I have forgotten? Is there anything I'm scared to face or acknowledge? Is there anything I am scared to admit? I want to come to terms with my past and leave it behind me. Is there anything I have forgotten, left out? Is there anything that scares me? There is one thing that haunts me from page 1 to page 22. I have never spoken of it. I have never told another person what I did to that man, how violently out of control I was, how badly I hurt him. It haunts me. I pick up the pen, and I pick up my stack of yellow paper, and I fold it in half. I place the stack in my pocket. I pick up the pad and the pen, and I stand, and I walk back across the grass. The sun is starting to fall. The breeze is starting to pick up. It is no longer singing. It is screaming, screaming bloody murder. I open the sliding glass door, and I walk to the shelves. I put the pad and the pen in their proper place. The unit is crowded with men relaxing before dinner. I don't speak to any of them. I walk up the stairs, and I go to my room, and I walk into the bathroom, and I stand before the mirror. I have written the wrongs of my life. They are in my pocket. I want to see if I can face myself. I put my hands on the sink. They shake against the white porcelain. I start to look up toward the mirror. I can see my lips quivering. I get to my nose, to the black lashes beneath my eyes. I go to the bottom of my eyes, to the pale green, to the dirty green, to the green that is impure. I am staring at the bottom of the green. There is only one thing keeping me from looking into my own eyes, looking into my own self, looking into the past that is mine and that is in my pocket, that motherfucker in Paris. There is only one thing. I let go of the sink and I turn and I walk out of the bathroom. I walk to the dining hall and I eat dinner with Miles and Michael. After dinner, I go to the lecture, but I don't listen to it. After the lecture, I go back to my room. I try to read, but I can't. I climb into bed and I try to sleep. There is one thing that haunts me. Still. I sleep through the night, without interruption, without the aid of chemicals. It is the second night in a row I have slept without interruption and without drugs and alcohol. It is a new record. When I wake, it is morning, early morning. Not dark, but not yet light. It is gray. Gray like fading sadness. Gray like rising fear. Not dark, but not yet light. I get out of bed. Miles is asleep. I walk quietly to the bathroom. I shower, and I shave, and I brush my teeth. I get dressed, and I leave the room. I get a cup of coffee, and I sit down at a table, and I drink the coffee. And I smoke cigarettes, and I watch the men do their morning jobs. One cleans the kitchen, one takes out the garbage, one vacuums the floor. I see a man carrying the supplies for the group toilets. They seem so long ago, the group toilets. Roy, so long ago. I finish the coffee. I walk through the halls to the dining hall. I get another cup of coffee, and I look for a table. Matty is alone in the corner. I sit with him. He stares at his food. I can see his eyes. They are bloodshot and swollen. A fork shakes in his hand. A glass shakes in the other. He stares at his food. I speak. You okay, Matty? He shakes his head. What's wrong? He shakes his head. Is there anything I can do? He shakes his head. Do you want me to leave? He shakes his head. I sit with him. I sit with him and I sip my coffee. He sits and he stares at his food. His hands shake and he doesn't speak. He just stares at his food. I finish my coffee and I stand and I ask him if he needs anything. He looks up at me and he speaks. Don't leave. I sit back down. Okay. He looks at me. His eyes are bloodshot and swollen. I need someone to sit with me. I'm here. He looks at me. His eyes are bloodshot and swollen. It's over, James. What do you mean? My fucking life. It's fucking done. What are you talking about? He sets down his fork, releases his glass. His hands continue to shake. I found out my wife started smoking. Started smoking what? He starts to break down. Fucking rock. He stops himself. Shit, Matty, I'm sorry. He shakes his head. She had never done it before. She was supposed to take care of our kids until I got out of here. She got all fucking curious about what the shit was and why it did what it did to me. And she went out and she fucking tried some. How'd you find out? My grandma called me. Said she went by the house and found the kids alone. They hadn't been fed in a couple of days, and our little one was sitting on the floor in a dirty fucking diaper. She waited there till my wife came back, and when she did, she was all fucked up and babbling and shit, and she said she'd been out smoking. Oh, I'm sorry, Matty. Ain't your fucking fault. What are you gonna do? I don't fucking know. My fucking wife has always been the one that held us together while I was out fucking up. And if she's on this shit, things are gonna fall the fuck apart. You can't have kids or have a family with two parents that are rockheads, and I probably won't be able to stay clean if she's fucking smoking. What about getting her some help and going back to boxing? Look at me, James.
I can't fucking fight no more. My body is wrecked. My head is all fucked up. I wouldn't last 30 fucking seconds in a ring with the worst fucking fighters in the world. And as much as I want her to get help, we spent the last chunk of my fighting money paying for me to come here, and we ain't got nothing else. We ain't got fucking shit.
Can I do anything to help?
Not unless you got a big-ass chunk of money sitting around that you want to give me.
I don't. I'm fucked, James. It's all over.
Something will work out.
I've seen too much of the fucking rock to believe that bullshit. I'm gonna die, she's gonna die, and our kid's gonna grow up to be just like us. We're all fucked. Totally fucked.
He stands. I gotta go for a fucking walk.
He picks up his tray.
Thanks for listening to me.
He walks away. I watch him. I pick up my coffee cup and I stand, and I walk to the conveyor, and I set my cup on it. I walk down the glass corridor separating men and women. I see Miles and Ted walking toward me. They are close together, and their heads are turned down. Their lips are moving, but barely. Miles looks up at me, and he gives me a slight nod, acknowledging me, and he continues speaking to Ted. They walk past me. I leave them alone. I go back to my room. I open the nightstand next to my bed. I take the stack of paper, the 22 pages, and I put them in the pocket of my pants. I leave my room and I walk through the halls. They're gray like the morning, like fading sadness, like rising fear. I am aware of them, but they don't bother me. I know them too well. They don't bother me. I knock on Joanne's door. She says, come in. I open the door and I step inside. She is sitting behind her desk, reading the paper, drinking coffee, smoking a cigarette. She speaks.
How are you?
I'm good.
You ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Anything you want to talk about before we go?
No.
She sets down her paper, stubs out her cigarette. After lunch today, I need you to come back here. Ken and I want to go over some things with you.
Is everything okay?
We have a recovery plan we'd like you to follow after you leave here.
Anything in it I'll actually do?
Probably not, but it would be irresponsible not to present it to you.
Okay.
You want to go?
Yeah.
She stands. We walk out of her office and through the halls. The halls are still gray, though a few shades darker, like deeper sadness, like greater fear. We do not talk as we walk, and with each step the memory of that night grows stronger. I just wanted to be alone. I was crying. He came to me, and I destroyed him, his spilling blood. I fucking destroyed him.
We stop at a door. A sign on the door reads, Father David, Chaplain, Religious Services.
Joanne knocks on the door. A voice says, come in. She tells me to wait for a moment, and she opens the door. And she walks inside, and she closes the door behind her. I stand, and I wait. I start to shake. My hands and legs and lips are shaking. My heart is shaking. If they were part of me, the halls would be black, with sadness and fear, with the darkest darkness that lives within me. They would be jet-fucking-black. I am shaking.
The door opens. Joanne steps out and she stands in front of me. She speaks.
He's ready for you.
All right. I told him there might be some uncomfortable moments. He said it's probably nothing he hasn't heard before.
We'll see. Good luck.
Thank you.
She reaches out and she puts her arms around me and she hugs me. She speaks.
You'll feel better when it's over.
I nod. She lets go of me. I reach for the door. My arm is heavy. I pull the door. It weighs 1,000 pounds. I open it and I don't want to go in. I don't want to do this.
Joanne is standing behind me and I turn and I look at her and she smiles and her smile allows me to step forward. Into the office. I close the door behind me. A priest sits behind a desk. He is wearing black. He is wearing a white collar. He is old, in his 70s. He has gray hair and dark brown eyes. A crucifix hangs on the wall behind him. A worn leather Bible sits on top of a stack of papers. It is the first time since that night that I have been in the presence of a priest. As I stare at him, the fury rises. He stands, and he looks at me, and he speaks. "Hello, my son. My name is Father David." "All due respect, sir, but I'm not your son. My name is James." "Hello, James."
"Hello.
Would you like to sit down?"
He motions to a chair on the far side of his desk. It is across from him. I sit down.
"Thank you." He sits in his chair.
"You're here for your fifth step."
"I don't believe in the steps. I'm here to make a confession."
"Are you a Catholic?"
"No."
"I can't take a confession unless you are a Catholic."
"Would you like me to leave?"
"Are you comfortable calling this a conversation?"
"Yes."
"Why don't we do that?"
"Thank you."
"Do you have any questions before you start?"
"No."
"Do you have any concerns?"
"No."
"You should be reassured that whatever you have to say this morning will never leave this room. It is between you and me and God."
"I don't believe in God, sir."
"Then it will be between you and me."
"Thank you."
"Would you like to begin?"
"Yes."
"Take as much time as you need."
I take a deep breath. I pull the 22 pages of yellow paper out of my pocket, and I set them in my lap. I look at them. They contain everything I can remember, except for one thing. I start reading. I read slowly and methodically. I read every word, and I recount every incident. Each page seems as if it takes an hour. As I move through them, I feel better, and I feel worse. Better because I am finally admitting my sins, and I am finally taking some form of responsibility for them. Worse because, as I speak of them, I relive them in my mind, each and every one of them. I relive them in my mind. When I am done reading, I take another deep breath. I look at the pages, and I fold them, and I put them back in my pocket. The priest speaks.
"Are you finished?"
I shake my head.
"No."
"It looks like you have read all that you have written."
"There was one thing I didn't write about."
"Would you like to tell me about it?"
"Yes."
"Take as much time as you need."
I look down. I look at my hands. They are shaking. I feel my heart. It is beating hard. It is scared. I am scared. I take another deep breath. I take another. Another. I am scared of speaking, scared of the memory. I am scared. I look up, into the eyes of Father David. They are deep and dark, and in them I do not see what I saw that night. In the eyes of this priest there is only peace and serenity and the security of his belief, not what I saw that night. I take another breath, one last breath. I exhale, I speak. 18 months ago in Paris, I beat a man so badly that he may have died.